Good morning. If you want to go ahead and open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 7, that's where we'll be at for the duration of the lesson this morning. Kind of picking up where Tyler's been going through the Sermon on the Mount, and today we're going to be kind of wrapping up that sermon. But before I get into the lesson, I do want to echo what Ryan said and thank the elders, and I really do appreciate this opportunity. I have been here for 15 years. I moved here in 2004, and it was not something I was looking forward to, and I remember coming here, and I thought, man, I don't know if I'm ever going to feel at home in a place like this. And several of you have asked me this morning even, you know, hey, is your family gone? Have they all flown down to Florida already? A lot of you seem to know a lot about my family's vacation plans, but what I incorrectly stated was, yeah, my family's gone, but the truth is, my family is still here. You are my family, and over 15 years, I have grown to love each and every one of you, and you have been a huge part of my life and shaped who I am today. And so, I did want to make sure and let you all know that. But as you know, I always find it's weird to say that I, you know, thank the elders, because you all know it's a little biased, right? Like, I do kind of have an inside man, you know, in the elder group. Right, Lanny? You know what I mean? But it truly is a blessing to be able to be here with you this morning and study God's Word. So Matthew chapter 7. Read with me verse 21 through 23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. But he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name cast out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. So here we have Jesus providing an interaction on the judgment day. It's a back and forth between Jesus and a group of men, a group of servants, or, you know, don't have a whole lot of background on them. But we can glean a few things quickly from what these men say in their interaction to Jesus on the judgment day. I think there are three things we can decipher about them. And based on verse 21, I think the first thing we can say is that they are believers. Notice how they addressed Jesus. Lord, Lord. Do you normally call Jesus Lord if he is not who you believe to be the Christ, who you believe to be the Son of God? So these men are proclaiming Jesus as their Lord. They believe that Jesus is God. Another thing that stands out to me is how they use the phrase, Lord, Lord. Now, this particularly stands out for us as Bible studiers when we see different lessons in the Bible that use a repeated phrase, or specifically a repeated name, right? Like in 2 Samuel 19, David, when he's crying over Absalom being killed, you know, he uses the phrase Absalom, Absalom, or oh, my son Absalom, oh, my son Absalom. The repetition shows an emotional attachment to the saying. And another we could also think of is with Jesus' interaction with Martha in Luke chapter 10. He uses the phrase Martha, Martha. And we don't have to go much farther to see his interaction when Lazarus dies to know that Jesus was emotionally attached to this family. He was an emotionally attached man to this family. And that phrase kind of insinuates a deep emotional connection. So these people that are addressing Christ on the judgment day have an emotional attachment to him. That's why they proclaim him, Lord, Lord. So not only are they proclaiming him as their Lord, but they have some sort of emotional affinity for Jesus. And then the last thing we can glean from the three verses we just read about these people is they're spiritually active, right? Notice what it says in verse 22. Did we not prophesy? Did we not cast out demons? Did we not perform many miracles? Now, I don't think this is a question where Jesus would have responded back, no, you didn't do any of those things and problem's over. But they did these things. They were spiritually active people. And I don't know about you guys, but I didn't do any of those three things on my list. Luckily, I didn't have to cast out demons, perform miracles, or prophesy. But these men were spiritually active. They were engaged in spiritual acts in service to God. And yet, how They view themselves, I think, would fall in line with those three things. If we ask them, are you a believer? They'd say yes. Are you emotionally attached, connected, you know, fawning over Christ? Well, they'd say yes. Were you spiritually active for Christ? They'd say yes. But it doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter how they view themselves. All that matters, and what we need to look at here, is what does Jesus say about them? They give their three characteristics of who they are, but there's only one characteristic in which Jesus gives to them. Look what it says in verse 23. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. So they profess to be believers. They profess to be emotionally attached to Christ. They profess to be spiritually active for Christ. And yet Jesus says, the only thing I notice about you is that you were lawless in your actions. You did not adhere according to the law. So what can we glean about these men from that statement? Not only that they have said, but from what Christ has said. And we're not given enough in-depth knowledge, enough detail into this story to be able to go through, you know, 50 different compartments and say, well, they did this, they didn't do that. And that's not the point of this passage here. But I think the way that this message is meant to be approached by us is that these men could do all three of those things that they said, how they would declare themselves, and yet they could absolutely be, as Jesus declares them, lawless. And that's who they ultimately are, lawless people, and those who live outside the law, those who do not ultimately submit to the law. And what is the law? Well, Jesus gives us that information in verse 21. He who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. So that is the law in which they are judged by, the will of God, his words. And they did not adhere to them. Even though I think most of us would agree, you want to believe in God. That's got to do that. We got to have an emotional connection to God. We've got to act on behalf of God. I think we would all agree those fall under the criteria. But we can still fall short of truly adhering to the will of God. Whether it's through lip service, whether it's, yeah, I love Jesus, or I wear, you know, a crucifix around my neck, or I wear cross rings or earrings or whatever. You know, I can outwardly pour out these emotions. I can profess to love Christ. I can come and worship. I can do all these things. And yet I still think we fall into this realm of, am I like these men who come before Christ and say, God, I did this, I did this, I did this. And yet he could still respond, you were lawless. Your life reflects a lawless life. And so we have to be willing to, you know, intrinsically look at ourselves and say, am I a compartmentalized Christian? Am I a Christian who has put myself into a simple, small box? I have adhered to a certain things of the law. The things that, when I probably look down at the nitty-gritty, are things that I am more capable of doing easier without much sacrifice. Am I adhering to parts of the law that don't truly involve a lot of sacrifice? Am I adhering to parts of the law that don't require a lot of generosity? I don't know what it is. I think the beauty of it is we can place all of our deficiencies in this passage and still find this relatable to us. So this isn't a passage to go through all of the possibilities in which, well, what makes us lawless? What makes us good? You know, that's not what this is about. But it's making us understand that you cannot simplify down our lives as Christians, our responsibilities as Christians, into the three distinct details that these men provide Jesus. And I think the most important thing we need to look at when we talk about these men is, think of how bold they are. This is the scene of judgment, right? And they are going up to Jesus and arguing with him, essentially, right? No. Whoa. You don't understand. I did this. I did this. I did this, right? I think about, you know, being a teacher, and I think a lot of times as being a teacher, I think about being a student more so when I try and think about things. And I always think, you know, whenever I got a grade, I was never that kid that went up and said, I'm sorry, Mrs. Smith, like, this ain't no 87. This is definitely a 94. All right. Like, clearly you got things. Like, I was not that kid. If I wrote the perfect essay and I failed, I just assumed I failed. Okay. Like, I took whatever came with it. And certainly I would not have the ability to stand up before Jesus on the judgment day and say, Jesus, you got this wrong. Clearly, I adhere to the rubric, and you must have forgot the rubric, Jesus. Because that's essentially what these people are doing. They had deceived themselves into thinking that they were lawless men. They had self-deceived. And the truth and the scary part of it, as Christians, as people that are trying to adhere to the law, it's easy for us to be self-deceived, to live our lives in a way that we adhere to parts of the law, neglect others, and can deceive ourselves into thinking that we are completely adhering to all parts of the law, all manners of the law. I wish I could tell you it was easy to be able to pinpoint and notice when things are missing or when we're not adhering, but the truth is, it's hard. And over time, we neglect it to the point that we thought it was never necessary to begin with. And that's what these men had become, to the point that Jesus is truly having his name taken in vain. Because these are men professing to be Christians who Christ says, you are not Christians. You are not Christians at all, because Christians adhere to the law that I have given them. They have adhered to the words that have come from the will of the Father. And these men had not done that. So they were professing to be Christians and yet living as unlawless men. So those are the two ways in which the people saw themselves and the way Jesus saw them. So how should we be seen? How should Jesus see us? Well, I think in Luke chapter 6 and verse 46, you don't have to turn there. I'm just going to read the verse quick. Jesus kind of asked this question, which in the same way is an answer because, you know, he gets things done quick. He gets to the point. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I say? Right? That so specifically applies to the situation we're reading here in Matthew, where these men are professing him as Lord, Lord. And I believe they have chosen God to be their Lord. And they believed in him, and they had an emotional attachment, and they were all those things that they said they were. But Jesus can still ask the question, you know, why do you say those things and not actually do what I say? You know, why do we profess things and yet act in a way that we don't truly believe what we profess? And that's what Jesus is asking these people in Luke, and that's really what he's asking them here in Matthew. He's like, yeah, I get the lip service. You can come every Sunday. You can come and we can be here every Sunday, every Wednesday, every Bible study in a person's home. And you can sing and you can talk and you can pray. And yet, do you actually do? Do you actually do what Christ says? Do you actually fulfill the will of God in your life? Or is it all lip service? Right? Because we say a lot of things that we're supposed to do in here. And we're doing a lot of things we're supposed to do in here. But we're not doing everything that we are commanded to do in the law when we meet here on Sundays or on Wednesdays. So is that lip service? Well, I would admit yes if this is where it ends. If once you get out of these doors, Christian time is over. Football time has begun. Or more importantly, lunchtime has started, right? You know, if you think about it, if everything in your being is supposed to be a Christian, right? And I always say this in Bible class, and I am preaching to myself first and foremost. Why are we in such a hurry to get out of here then? Right? Why are we in such a hurry? Why is 9 a.m. just seem to be the earliest time imaginable? Why, when I set my alarm, is that just way too early and I need to push it back? Right? If this is who we are, if this is what we're called to do and we profess to be, then why are we in such a hurry to get to the other parts of life? Why is this such a checklist kind of lifestyle that we are tempted to fall into? Why is it such a degrading, you know, draining part of our lives? To where I'm falling asleep in class, you know, I can't get to services on time because I have to sleep in, or, you know, and I'm not throwing anyone under the bus because I've done all the above and worse, and I don't even have any kids, so my excuse is worse than your guys', all right? But why are you so exhausted to be here? Why are we so drained to be here? Why are we so ready to leave? People move faster than they've ever moved before when the bell rings and Bible class is over, and then when, you know, final song sung, prayer's done, and I just can't wait to get out of here and forget absolutely everything that just happened. Why? Because when we do that, when we live our lives in such a way that we act like that, What's going to make us different from these men? What's going to make us any different? I can still say I called Jesus Lord. I can still say I was a Christian. I can still say I came and I was singing. I love to sing. I was a part of the prayer service. I led prayers. You know, I led the Lord's Supper. I partook of the Lord's Supper. I preached. I've done everything. And I could still fall into the lawless crowd. I could be as lawless as anyone else. Because at the end, it's not what I do, truly. It's how I live. It's not just the simple things we do Sunday and Wednesday and, you know, a couple times, maybe on a Monday night or a Tuesday night or whenever you have your Bible study. It goes beyond that. Is Christianity a life choice for you? Or is it a lifestyle? Is it your life? And the difference is, we are so in a hurry to live our life, right? You ask someone, ask somebody, if somebody asked me, you know, Caleb, is your life being a teacher? Well, no, that's what I do. Well, Caleb, is your life being a Purdue fan? Maybe. All right. Is your life, you know, doing this or that? Is your life, you know, and we're always like, no, that's what I do. No, that's what I like. No, that's this. That's what is our life then? And if we start saying, you know, that's just what I do. That's my job. Well, tell me, your job has hours of operation, right? Monday through Friday, probably. If you have a terrible job, Monday through Saturday. But, you know, that's just what I do. I clock in, I clock out. Okay, well, what if I told you that you had a job that, you know, the hours weren't too bad. You know, Monday and Wednesdays, about 5 hours a week. All right, you come in, you do some things, you leave. Where's the difference in it being a lifestyle, being your life versus being your job? Being another check mark for the weekly, you know, journal. You know, what's the difference? What separates this from everything else in our life, from all the other compartments in our life? And we can say that, well, none of them really are about spiritual belief and spiritual emotional connection to Christ or anything. Well, then why do you treat it like it's just anything else? Why do I treat it like it's just anything else? To where if I'm narrowed down like these men are, you know, I narrow it down to God, I believed. God, I acted. God, I cared. That's essentially how these men. Well, how much do you care? This is kind of ironic because last night, knowing I was going to be here preaching, last night I was in a haunted barn wearing a devil's mask scaring people, right? If that's not irony, I don't know what is, right? And now I'm up here professing that I believe Jesus is God, right? But like, we have so many compartments in our lives. How do I keep my Christian life from being a compartment? How do I keep it from being that small piece of my life instead of being my life? How do I do that? I'm always that jerk that's like, I don't know, you guys are going to have to figure that out for yourself or wait until Tyler gives you a lesson on it. But that's the challenge. All right, I like to issue challenges without any solutions. So, you know, that's the challenge. Don't compartmentalize your Christian life into just a box that you meet on one day, meet on maybe a second day, maybe a third day if you're feeling extra spiritual that week. Don't put Christianity in that box, because if you are, there's no way you can approach the throne of God and profess to be living according to the will of God if we're putting God into a little compartment in our lives. And here's the last thing I want to focus on, the last point in the lesson, really. What's the punishment then? What's the punishment of being someone who lived a lawless life, right? Of being someone who, you know, maybe adhered to parts of the law, knew parts of the law, followed parts of the law, but didn't ultimately truly submit and make the will of God your life. What's the punishment for that, according to Jesus? Well, verse 23. I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me. That it? That it, Jesus? You're just going to forget us? You're just going to say you don't know us like that? I mean, I think we're getting off a little bit easy. Well, maybe not. Because what's one thing every person, I think deep down, actually wants? To be remembered. People want to be remembered. Each and every one of us, and I'll be bold enough to say this, you know, because I'm bold like that. But every one of us has that story in our past that we love when people tell it. Whether it's a childhood story or something from a couple weeks ago or something, you're just like, oh, this is great. Like, my parents are always going to tell this story to everybody, or my friends are always going to tell it. It's going to be brought up. And like, when people bring it up, you're like, oh, no, don't tell that story. It's like, what? No. Actually, it was on a Wednesday night, and the rain was coming down at a slight slant. And like, we remember every detail, and we just perk up when we hear it. It's a high. It's like an emotional high we get. It's like, oh, they're telling that story again. That's great. And I'm not trying to make us all like, you know, arrogant, pompous people. We're people. Like, people love to be remembered. People love for our deeds to be remembered. You know, look at history. That's all history is us remembering things people did, right? How they did it. You don't think Alexander the Great wanted to be remembered? The dude named 700 cities Alexandria. Like, at some point in time, he's like, whenever they think I've done enough, I'm going to add one more city, right? Just in case that area forgets. Like, he wants to make sure his name is known. The thing I learned more than anything when I went to Israel is, my goodness, Herod wanted to make sure he was remembered forever. That dude did not want to be forgotten. We don't want to be forgotten either. We want to be remembered. I don't think all of us are as, you know, naive to think that we're going to be on a huge scale and be remembered by everyone from every corner of the globe. But we want to be remembered. I have a very close relationship with my grandmother. Once a month, I travel down to where I grew up in Cambridge City, and I preach there at this local congregation. And my grandparents and my family has always lived in Connersville, just a few minutes away, about 15 minutes away, and worshiped at the church there, and that's where I grew up. And so every month I go down and I preach there, and afterwards I meet my grandparents, and we have lunch, go home, and spend some time there. They have evening worship at 6 o'clock. So when you go from having one worship service kind of combined to then you have to go at 9 and 6, it's like Sunday became 42 hours long. Like, it's incredible. So I'm always at my grandparents' house, which has become one of the great blessings in my life, being able to go down there and spend time with them. My grandmother, you know, who I've grown up with, we spent countless hours over at their house, days, weeks, all the time. We would go over there. That's where we would go when we were kids. And sure enough, that's where I go now, right? Like, on the weekends, it seems. Every weekend, I'm back there. And they're characters. My grandparents are characters. Just imagine something crazy and then add a couple little bit more pieces of crazy, and that's my grandparents. My grandmother has dementia now. She is not the same person that I knew growing up. She doesn't have the same, you know, conversation. She doesn't say the same kind of things. I don't really get to talk with her about much of substance anymore. You know, I used to come in crying because I was the little one that got picked on playing sports. And, you know, she would always, you know, tell me, hey, you know, you stay in here with me. And, you know, I'd be like, no, I got to go back out there and face those giants. But she's different now. She can't remember those things. Last time I went down a couple months ago, had lunch like normal. My grandmother introduced herself to me. She did not remember who I was. When I heard the phrase, you know, hi, I'm Betty Eldridge, a simple phrase, a kind, tender-hearted woman saying it to just a young man, it was the worst thing I'd ever heard. Because every part of my history, every part of the time that we spent together just seemed like it was erased. It was gone. It was no longer there. There was nothing that we shared anymore. And then I read a phrase like this in Matthew chapter 7. where it's not my grandmother, who I love as much as anything in this world, but it's something far greater in the Creator of the universe, in Jesus, that looks me in my eye and says, I don't know you. Someone I thought I had a relationship with. Someone I thought I was adhering to certain parts of the law, certain aspects of the law. And if people ask me, I'd say, yeah, I know Jesus. Jesus knows me. Jesus claimed me. I'm in the kingdom. But at the ultimate point of our existence, and this is the ultimate point, right? The ultimate point where we stand before the throne of God and we have to ask the ultimate question of ourselves, and God's going to give us the answer. But the ultimate question of life, ultimately, does God know you? Does God remember you? Because to be forgotten is horrible. Someone you thought you had a relationship, it stinks when you've forgotten that. And some of you have experienced that. Some of you experience it daily, I'm sure. But there is nothing that compares to being someone who is not remembered by God. Because we lived our lives saying, I don't care if God remembers me. There's nothing worse. And it's at that point where no longer does the weeping and the gnashing of teeth seem to be the worst part of what hell has to offer. The fires, the brimstone, none of that seems to be the worst part. It seems to be the eternity where I have to sit there in agony asking the same question. Why didn't he remember me? Why didn't God remember me? Why didn't he claim me? There's not a much worse thing I can imagine than to live forever saying God doesn't remember me. I want to be remembered by God. So ultimately, let's read these last few verses of Matthew chapter 7 and figure out how do I do that. Starting with verse 24. Therefore, everyone, noticing therefore, as Tyler commonly says, means the stuff that would just happen based on the information just given by Jesus. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house. And yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rains fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. So truly, I have to build a house. My life has to be a house, and I get to choose how I build it, right? Because truly the most important thing about a person's house is not the rooms you have in it, not the paint on the outside. It's where you actually built your foundation. And in real life, that's true, you know? Right? Do you live in Avon? Do you live in China? Do you live in California? Like, you have to set down your roots somewhere. You can change the rooms how you like, but at some point you have to make a decision. Where am I going to plant my foundation? And we as Christians have to make that same choice in our lives. Where am I going to plant my foundation? Am I going to plant it in myself, in my family, in my friends, in my relationships, even with people in the church? Or am I going to plant it in Christ? Am I going to base the foundation of my life, of my house, of my entire being on the words of God? Because if I do that, if I adhere to the words of God and build my foundation on that, I'm built on a rock. And I don't know much. I don't know how big the house is. I don't know how fancy. I don't know what kind of floors I've got. All I know is that when the floods come and the storms hit, it's not falling. It's not going down. So I don't know what kind of house, you know, got that old cliche preacher ending, right? I don't know what kind of house you built today, right? And I don't. I don't know anything about anyone else's true household except my own. Each of us only knows truly how our foundation is. All I know is if it's founded in Jesus, you don't have to test it. You don't have to question it. You can just know. The storms can come. The waves can hit. It's not going anywhere. You need to make Christ not a house, not a room in your house that you visit, not even a whole floor, but the house itself must be based on the words of Christ. Your entire existence must be firmly cemented on the belief that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and adhering to the will that He has laid out for our lives. That's our only responsibility. He who hears these words of mine and does them. He who hears these words of mine and does them. I hope that you heard the words of God today. But more importantly, I hope you go out and do them. I hope you go out and do them. I hope everyone can see that your life is different than the people around you, because your life is founded on the rock. Your life is stable. Your life is immovable. And that's not because things didn't come and challenge you along the way, but it's because when things did come, you were able to stand against it, because God was standing with you. So whatever your situation is this morning, whether you've built it on the sand, we've got more tools here to be used. Man, I hate using the cliches, you know. Just the time is now to change your life, right? Time is now to change your life. If you've never been founded and living a life according to the life of Christ, adhering to the will, according to the words that He has spoken, and it's the words that He spoke, right? It's the words that are the foundation. What He says, will you do it? That's how you build your house. If you want to get off the beach, and nowadays nobody wants to move off the beach, but I want to move off the beach. I want to move on to the rock. I want to be firm and solidified in everything I do. Because I've lived too much of my life, even being a Christian, I've lived too much of my life feeling concerned and weary and exhausted about what comes at me. And I'm blessed enough that I haven't even had a lot come at me, I think. So those of you that have even endured more struggle and more heartache, I know, are probably dealing with the struggle and pain and anguish and suffering that I can't even imagine bearing. Right now is the time. Right now is the time. Not tomorrow, not next week, not later this afternoon. Right now. Come forward, change your life. Change it from being about you to being about Christ. And if you've changed your life before and you need to change it back, if you need to change it back, the opportunity's now. Because there's nothing more beautiful that I can imagine than I get to stand before the throne of God. It says, Caleb, I remember you. I remember you. That can give me comfort. Because it's not who you know in this life. It's who knows you. And it's not the higher up CEOs. And it's not the wealthy. And that's not the privilege and the advantage. It's just one. Just one person you need to make sure knows you. If you want to make sure He knows you, if you want to know Him, please come forward now as we stand and sing this song.